And we're going to bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen right now. And she's pretty good at laughing, too. But we got a lot of serious stuff.
I've been taking care of business. You don't mind taking care of business.
Good morning, Angie.
Good morning, Ursula. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. As you know, one of the biggest issues right now is what parents are dealing with as far as kids going to school. Today is the first day of school in Georgia. Schools in other states, including Indiana, are open. Florida, they're already approving reopening plans. And here in our state, we actually talked to four of the Republican frontrunners for governor, and all of them, Angie, said that they would open schools this fall. And we want you to hear what Dr. Raul Garcia told us yesterday.
We worked really hard last Monday to roll out a strategy to return the kids back to school. And we looked at every scientific data from all over the world about our children to back it up. And what we found out is that really children 10 and under don't get this virus. And this was mind-blowing for me as a physician, because influenza doesn't work this way. RSV doesn't work this way. This is completely the opposite.
So we were confused because we have actually seen that there are reports. So what is your data showing you as far as kids under the age of 10?
So that is completely incorrect, what he said, that children under the age of 10 do not get this virus. There are some questions as to whether children under 10 are as susceptible as children older than that and adults, which means that fewer of them may get this virus, but we don't really have hard data about that. What is for sure is that some children under the age of 10 do contract this virus, and furthermore, that they are capable of shedding infectious virus and potentially transmitting it to other people, and in very rare cases can develop very, very serious disease. This Kawasaki syndrome-like disease, which is a multi-system inflammatory disorder that can actually be lethal. So that is completely untrue that children under 10 are somehow immune or resistant to contracting SARS coronavirus 2.
And I want to actually talk also about what happened at that summer camp in Georgia. I suppose that would be another more evidence, because one of the biggest things that we're dealing with, Angie, and I know you know too, is that everyone seems to be looking at different science. But here's something that actually happened in a summer camp in Georgia. Are you familiar with that, where like 260 campers and staff tested positive?
I am familiar with that situation, and it really just verifies what I just told you, that children under the age of 10 may not get as serious of disease most of the time, but they are certainly capable of being infected with this virus, and in some cases developing serious COVID from it. We also know that there have been numerous reports of newborn babies being infected in the hospital, testing positive. In many of those cases, it's not clear how they were infected, but if you're in a hospital, not to mention if your mother has COVID, it's entirely possible to contract that during birth or while feeding the child, while being in close contact with the child. So it's just plain not true that children under 10 are resistant to the virus.
Dr. Rasmussen, give us some good news in regards to COVID. What kind of good news do you have for us?
Well, there are several vaccines that have been putting out data regarding their clinical trials as well as preclinical studies. And the good news is that there are numerous vaccine candidates that appear to be effective at generating immunity in people, meaning they induce neutralizing antibodies, which are antibodies that are capable of rendering the virus non-infectious. They also, in many cases, appear to induce T cell responses that we think are associated with antiviral immunity. In addition to that, in monkey studies using rhesus macaques that have been vaccinated, and then they get what we call a challenge dose. We basically intentionally infect vaccinated animals with the virus to see how well the vaccine works. The vaccines appear to work pretty well. They don't provide completely sterilizing immunity, meaning they don't completely protect from being infected at all in every single animal that was tested, but they do appear to protect against severe disease. So this is really good news in terms of these vaccines being likely to work. We still need to confirm that in phase 3 trials that are starting up now, but that's a really positive, encouraging sign.
As long as you're talking about vaccines, what is your position? Because as you have told us, I mean, there could be a couple of different ones. And I know that there are some prominent people already saying, hey, I'm not going to be taking it, you know, right off the bat. So what would you need to hear that would convince you, yes, I could take the vaccine? Or who would be best protected to take the vaccine so they wouldn't be, you know, more jeopardized as far as their health, if that makes sense?
Yeah, that does. So I know a lot of people have been concerned that so-called Operation Warp Speed is moving so fast that too many corners are going to be cut with regard to the normal vaccine development pipeline. And this is a concern. I think that as long as we are approving vaccines and making them available for use based on hard data obtained in these phase 3 clinical trials, that would be enough for me to justify taking the vaccine. I think one thing to keep in mind here, though, is that when these vaccines are approved, provided they have gone through a rigorous clinical trial, it's still going to be some months before they are available to everybody. Initially, people will be prioritized based on certainly professions like healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers who are at increased exposure risk. I don't know what the CDC, which runs the panel that decides this priority, what they've decided. But there probably will be other people who are at higher risk of severe disease who will be prioritized to receive the vaccine. That's going to depend a lot on these clinical trials and what the results are in terms of their safety profiles and their efficacy profiles in these different groups. So it's going to be a while before most people will even have access to these vaccines once they're approved. So we may have more data by the time these show up in your local Walgreens or doctor's office to assess how safe they are.
Dr. Rasmussen, a lot of folks now are wearing masks. I want to applaud those here, especially in areas that I'm around. I'm seeing a lot more people are wearing masks, and it's being mandated in different areas of the country. What kind of... Also, any good news about what us wearing masks is doing right now? Is it helping with the increases? Talk about that.
Well, I wouldn't say that we actually have really hard data on how well masks are working at the community level. We have more data about how well masks work in a hospital or healthcare setting, but it's a lot harder to figure that out at the community level, especially now. We can't really do randomized clinical trials with masks versus no masks in communities. And we also have different communities using masks at different rates. There are different perspectives on mask wearing, I should say, and some communities are more likely to mask up than others. So it's really difficult to try to figure out and quantify the type of effects that masks are having. But it's definitely encouraging that more people seem to be coming around to them. I've certainly been more satisfied with some of the federal political messaging about mask wearing that has come out. And I think that more people are gradually adopting masking. So hopefully people will adopt it and we will be able to actually get some data to support the idea that masks do, in fact, reduce transmission.
Yesterday, when we had Dr. Garcia on our show, there was something, I mean, yeah, when he talked about those under 10 not being able to get the coronavirus, I didn't even follow up. I left that one alone. However, there was something that he said, Dr. Rasmussen, that really stuck with me all night. And I actually kind of agree with it. He said that one of the biggest things that we can do to try to fight this coronavirus outside of wearing a mask and doing the right responsibility things for others would be how we take care of ourselves. And health wise and trying to be healthy just in case we catch the coronavirus. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's always good advice. Certainly, you know, being well and being healthy is in general a good thing to do. We don't know much about how that impacts coronavirus, though. We certainly know that people with certain medical conditions, as well as people over the age of 70, have a higher risk, but we don't really know much about what determines disease severity in people who are healthy. We furthermore don't know much about the long-term effects of getting coronavirus and then recovering. there have been many reports of people having long-term symptoms, and in some cases, fairly severe long-term symptoms after they've cleared the viral infection. So I think it's always good advice to stay healthy and to stay fit as much as possible. But it's not clear that that actually provides a risk reduction for people in if they were to get coronavirus.
Dr. Rasmussen, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb said recently that virus deaths could double by the end of this year.
In the United States, probably, you know, by the end of the year, we could have upwards of 300,000 if we continue on the current trajectory. Right now, we have close to 1,000 casualties a day. So if we don't change that trajectory, you could do the math and see where we are towards the end of the year.
So when you heard that, what is your reaction?
I completely agree with Dr. Gottlieb about that. I think that right now, I mean, we are on a trajectory to have 11,000 deaths per week in the United States. There are many states in which case numbers aren't even slowing down. Death curves are up in almost all 50 states. We are really in the midst of a public health crisis. In Washington state, for example, we are having more new cases than we had in March or April when we were the nation's first hotspot. So this is a real crisis. And I mean, I think that 300,000 deaths may be an underestimate if we continue on the trajectory we're on, especially because we don't know how flu season is going to impact this. There are some reports from China that there were patients in Wuhan early in this outbreak who were co-infected with influenza virus. So it's really important that people get their flu shots this year because having an influenza epidemic at the same time as this coronavirus pandemic could make this an even bigger public health catastrophe.
Okay, I'm going to lighten it up a little bit. There's a new study that finds men over 6 feet tall are twice as likely to get COVID. Is that for real? Is this something good for short guys?
So this is a great example of correlation not equaling causation. In this study that you're mentioning, I think there were 2,000 individuals who they looked at, and they saw this higher risk in men who are over 6 feet tall. I haven't looked at the numbers to see what the distribution of height were for the men in that group, but we do know that there is a very clear sex bias with this virus. So men are more likely to get severely ill, and men are more likely to die. Men are also more likely to be over 6 feet than women are, which may just explain this is a man thing versus a tall thing. But it's something worth looking into. I realize that it does have potential implications for aerosol transmission and the types of exposure people of different heights may have by that route.
Here soon, right now, across the country, I mean, my friends in Tennessee, they posted back-to-school pictures in Georgia. They're back to school. And here soon, the state of Washington will be back to school. And the question will remain if it'll be in person. Or a lot of districts have already said, no, it will not be in person. It'll be over Zoom calls or whatever the case might be. Let's just say here in the state of Washington, Dr. Rasmussen, if school isn't safe to go to here maybe at the end of this month, if we don't when would possibly school be safe to go to? And is that a question that you can't answer?
So this is a question I can sort of answer. Right now, I don't think school is safe to return to anywhere in the United States just because of the high levels of community transmission. We can look at other countries that have safely reopened schools. They have done so when the rate of community transmission is less than, I think, 2 cases per 1,000 people in the population. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's the metric they were using. So that means if there's such low community transmission that you can stay on top of it through testing and contact tracing, isolation and quarantine, then you can safely reopen schools for everybody because you know that there's so little virus sort of circulating and hiding out in the community that if any new infections are caused, you can trace them and you can shut them down quickly. We are nowhere near the level of low community transmission we need to be at to safely reopen schools.
Before we let you go, we do have a wild card question for you. just so you know.
Hit me with it, G.
All right. Dr. Rasmussen, I have many phobias, but you always come on here with all of the answers. What is your phobia? What kind of phobia? What are you absolutely afraid of?
I hate spiders. That's an easy one. I'm terrified of spiders, and this is actually my least favorite time of year because it's spider season here in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, they are everywhere.
And we have those big black house spiders. Oh, I really, those brown ones that are like furry. I really hate those. I really hate the web weaving spiders that, like, you can walk into their webs and they get especially big in August and September. Just don't like any of them. I know that they're important for the ecology. I know that they help keep pest insects down, but I just can't stand them. Like, it's really visceral. I really do not like spiders.
So, like, if you see one, are you asking someone else to go get the spider, or are you getting it yourself?
That's a job for my husband. And whenever I go visit Chicken and Taz, my parents, I make them de-spider the backyard before I'll go eat a meal out there.
Hey, what was that name you said next to Taz?
Oh, my mom. Her name is Chicken.
Okay. Tell Chicken and Taz we said hello.
I will, absolutely.
Appreciate you.